culprit is the United States. We have to remember that Trump threatened to destroy Iran. He threatened even to destroy Iran's cultural sites. So when the Iranians retaliated for the assassination of General Soleimani in Baghdad, and they fired missiles at the occupation base in Iraq, where the American forces were based, the Al-Assad base, the Iranians were expecting an American counterstrike. And the officer who shot down the plane, he made a very, very tragic mistake and a very horrific mistake. But there's no doubt that if it wasn't for the American murder of General Soleimani, if it wasn't for the constant threats to destroy Iran by Trump, that this would never happen.
Iran is determined to neutralize U.S. hostility. Well, its parliament, for one, is. It was on February the 21st that elections for that new 11th parliament were held. And this is how results looked. 40 independents were elected, 19 reformists and moderates, and as many as 220 principalists. Voters opting for principalists was because they wanted a more decisive approach towards weak Western compliance with the JCPOA, the moderate government's pet project. There has been interesting activity in Parliament or the Islamic Consultative Assembly since, which I will be referring to later in the program. Blocking the transfer of medicine or the means to pay for it, that's oil money, or to transfer it, sanctions through and through. No, actually, you can call it genocide on the sly. Here's who's the culprit and who cares with Corona on the loose. Blocks on medicine and or banking so that Iran can't pay for drugs, raw materials and medical equipment. Culpability begins with the US, but the strain has carried on in Iran. This in spite of the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner called for the urgent reevaluation of sanctions against countries grappling with the global pandemic. Coronavirus disease, or COVID-19, was first reported from Wuhan in China on December the 31st, 2019. Iran confirmed its first cases on February the 19th, 2020. Those were two positive cases in Qom city. The disease spread rapidly to adjacent provinces and shortly thereafter to all 31 provinces. The Ministry of Health took action by seeing to the formation of the National Committee to Combat Corona. Iran was not alone in its suffering. West Asian economies contracted by an average of around 5% because lockdowns slowed down domestic economic activity and limited global demand. Pandemic-sensitive sectors such as tourism particularly suffered, as did oil prices. And unemployment and poverty that prevailed before 2020 worsened and is foreseen to worsen further in 2021. Most regional governments worked hard to manage the crisis, but carnage was unavoidable given limited fiscal space. Now, Iran has had U.S. sanctions, be they legal or not, to deal with on top of the pandemic. The country has grown resilient to sanctions that have been ongoing throughout its 40-plus year life of the revolution. But with a maximum pressure campaign, it's surviving by gasping for air.
Let me describe the situation of some countries around Iran these days. Most of them don't have any equipment or device for detecting this virus. And unfortunately, I should say, many of these countries don't even have a healthcare system. They can't even specify the number of infected people. For example, the healthcare system in Pakistan and Iraq are much inferior to that of Iran. In Iran, there are many labs which try to test this virus and other viruses, and our healthcare system is able to check this virus and give report to the World Health Organization every day.
U.S. restrictions on Iran's banking system and oil exports have limited this country's ability to finance and purchase essential items from abroad. That's drugs as well as raw materials and equipment needed to manufacture medicine domestically. Talking illegal, the Trump administration has even reduced the number of licenses it grants companies for certain medical exports to Iran. It is not possible to determine exactly how much U.S. sanctions have affected Iran's capacity to fight a virus, according to Iranian medical workers and global public health experts. It is clear, of course, that Iran has been deprived of equipment needed to control further infection and save lives. Iran has manufactured much, but surely its capacity to control the outbreak has been limited. The U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran nuclear deal in 2018. The deal that was supposed to lift sanctions off Iran in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Yet in 2020, America attempted a resolution to indefinitely extend the UN arms embargo on Iran. That would mean tampering with a provision of the JCPOA, which the U.S. no longer had any business with. But for all its maximum pressure campaign against Iran, the U.S. for once found itself receiving minimal support. The occasion was marked in mid-August as the UN Security Council resoundingly defeated the resolution, leaving Trump's America with support only from the Dominican Republic. In the 75 years of United Nations history, America has never been so isolated, the then Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Mousavi tweeted.
Despite all the pressure applied on Iran, it maintained its regional policy vis-à-vis its Middle East and Anatolian neighbors with which it has normal ties. Owing to deep-seated ties with neighbors, the country was spared serious economic harm, and the economic collapse the U.S. hoped to happen by 2019 did not happen. What is clear is that the Americans have failed in their pressure campaign to bring Iran to its knees.
JCPOA signatory China said, should the U.S. insist, regardless of international opinion, it is doomed to fail like today. Unilateralism receives no support and bullying will fail. Germany, however, ended 2020 by saying outright it did not trust Iran. Now, what might that mean for the JCPOA and Iran's compliance with the deal? Its compliance in limiting nuclear activity, that is.
No one in Iran cares for what anything the Germans have to say. What is important for Iran is the nuclear deal. If the Germans and Western countries want Iran to implement their side of the bargain, then they have to implement their side of the bargain. This is not an act of friendship. This is not a marriage. This is a deal. This is a deal that was negotiated over years. Both sides gave and both sides took.
The Iranian government may have had to struggle with domestic corruption, but external problems alone have been many, beginning with the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA to mostly just verbal compliance by other Western parties to that deal, and all forms of sabotage by the U.S. and or Israel, as assassinations and explosions of nuclear sites. Principalist parliamentarians submitted separate plans to Ghalibaf to withdraw from the JCPOA an additional protocol to the NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, that is, if it comes to it. Their resolve was intensified by the Natanz explosion and Fakhrizadeh assassination. Here's where I slip with the chronological. The explosion at Natanz uranium enrichment site was a major highlight of the year past. It was the result of sabotage and a tragedy. It caused major damage that would slow down the development of advanced uranium enrichment centrifuges. Natanz, much of which is underground, is one of several Iranian facilities monitored by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog, which certified 15 times that Iran was in full compliance with the nuclear deal. That's still before Iran was pushed into mincing away from its commitments, however reversibly so. Fatality was inflicted not just on a nuclear site, but a nuclear scientist. The last of several nuclear personalities assassinated over the years. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh departed on the 27th of November, 2020. Israel is not lightly suspected of the assassination, as it had marked the name Fakhrizadeh in addressing the world with accusations against Iran years back.
No, I don't think the statement that the Israeli regime carried out the murder of General Fakhrizadeh, Dr. Fakhrizadeh, Professor Fakhrizadeh, I don't think that's speculation. It's pretty clear from Trump's retweets, from what senior American officials, unnamed, said to the New York Times, and from other material that has come out, that the Israelis were involved. And ultimately, the Israeli regime will have to pay a price. But already the Americans are paying a price, because Parliament approved a law to expand Iran's nuclear program as a result of this murder and terrorist attack.
In my opinion, there are two goals behind this assassination. It's a general goal that those seeking to restrict Iran's military industry have stepped in to turn their demands into an operational stage and thus assassinate the father of Iran's military industry. This has been a large-scale goal. The second goal was tactical. They seek to force Iran to make a rash reaction to this event. Basically, Mr. Trump is working with Israel to make Iran do something that would make it fundamentally impossible to return to the deal.
With all that's come to pass, non or weak compliance with the JCPOA by Western parties to that deal, assassinations and sabotage, Parliament decided to put an end to a one-way game. Here's how. Iranian Parliament is resolute it will lift sanctions off Iran or ditch the deal. Its resolution is named Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions. The 1st of December saw MPs approve the outlines of that bill. This followed a phased reduction in Iran's commitments to the JCPOA, given what President Rouhani called the E3's support for the constant intensification of cruel American sanctions against Tehran.
Well, the Parliamentary Act was in response, partially, to the murder of Professor Fakhrizadeh. And it was a form of punishment. It was telling the United States that when you condone murder, when you give a green light to murder, this is the response that you get. But it is also sending a second message, and that is to Biden. And that is that if Biden wants to implement the nuclear deal, he can do it on day one. He can give presidential decrees and reverse everything that Trump has done within one day. His lawyers actually could be doing that right now. That was his intention. And the Iranians are saying, if you do not do so, that means you're buying time and you're playing games. And we're going to expand our nuclear program as a result.
According to the nine-article bill, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, will be required to produce and store at least 120 kilograms of enriched uranium with 20% purity at the Fordow nuclear facility every year to fulfill the country's peaceful industrial demands. Also, the organization is to increase the monthly output of enriched uranium for various peaceful purposes with different purity levels by at least 500 kilograms. And it is to increase the number of centrifuge machines to 1,000 within a year after the ratification of the bill. The bill also necessitates the inauguration of a metallic uranium factory in Isfahan within 5 months and restoration of a 40-megawatt heavy water reactor in Arak, which was supposed to be redesigned and optimized under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The bill requires the government to prevent any foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol and to suspend the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, 3 months after the ratification of it. Once again, that is if the parties to the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers fail to uphold their obligations under the deal.
The fact is that the impacts of the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and the intensification of sanctions on the Iranian society are quite obvious. We no longer accept negotiating on anything other than the nuclear issue. It's very natural. The other side is not trustworthy and has always been so.
That's all we've got on 2020 today. We will be back to cover events in the new year each week at the same time, so do tune in. Happy New Year.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is an excerpt of the speech delivered on October 24, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of the National Anti-Coronavirus Headquarters.
Some people have lost their jobs because of the coronavirus pandemic. Some of those who have lost their jobs do not have unemployment insurance. Therefore, the Social Security Organization should get involved on this matter. Of course, as I mentioned before, this problem is one of those which can be resolved with the help of the benefactor, as it is one of the best deeds for getting close to God, and it is also one of the best charitable acts. All the things that I mentioned are mere tools. He who gives life to these tools and who renders them efficient is God. With your grace, you render instruments useful, as it is mentioned in Sahifa al-Sajjadiyah, Dua 7. It is Allah the Exalted whom we should ask for help. We should pray and supplicate to Him. If God bestows His grace on our nation, as has always been the case, on this matter too, there are certain good people, and if they pray and raise their hands to pray, God will show His grace to our nation again. Then all the things that I mentioned, these tools will work and will become efficient.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
We should pray, supplicate, and ask for God's forgiveness. O God, forgive me for those sins which bring us punishment and pain. There are certain sins that bring people and societies divine punishment. O God, forgive me for those sins which block the path of prayers. O God, forgive me for those sins which lead to calamity. Therefore, repentance is necessary. We should repent so that Allah the Exalted bestows His grace and so that we will get through this difficult pass, inshallah.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Debate. Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Finally, Congress has certified the U.S. president-elect's electoral college victory, ending the plethora of the outgoing president's lawsuits. Now, this hours after a pro-Trump supporters stormed the Capitol Wednesday, four people died, many more got injured, and nearly 70 others got arrested. President Trump now saying he's committed to an orderly transition of power. Tons of condemnations pouring in from big names around the world, including from former U.S. presidents and U.S.'s European allies. Iran's President Rouhani is also regarded as an indication of the vulnerability and failure of Western democracy. Now, let's start the debate show. Let's first go to Washington, D.C., to our own correspondent there, Colin Campbell. Colin, tell about some of those reactions and give us some more details regarding this.
We have four sitting U.S. presidents who have condemned what happened on Capitol Hill on Wednesday afternoon when you had rioters and looters maraud through the halls of Congress. You had President Barack Obama making probably in the sharpest terms talking about how the current president, Donald Trump, incited some of that violence that occurred and resulted in the deaths of four people on Wednesday. And then, of course, you had the last sitting Republican president, George W. Bush, also condemning what happened and just said that what occurred was more reminiscent of a banana republic and not a democratic republic like we like to consider the United States. At the same time, we're receiving criticism from leaders all over the world, including those from France and the UK, like Boris Johnson, saying that there should be a more peaceful transfer of power. We have heard from the current president, Donald Trump, who did release a statement after the deaths yesterday of four people and dozens of injuries, saying that there would be a peaceful transfer of power on January 20th. Some people are saying that that should be taken with a grain of salt, considering the president does not always tell the truth and is not very straightforward, most times with several different things. So we're waiting to see, just days away, how this is all going to go, especially now that the votes from the Electoral College have been confirmed by the president's vice president, Michael Pence.
Okay, thank you for that. Dr. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now let me invite author and commentator David Swanson from Charlottesville, Virginia. Good to have you with us. First question for you is, let's talk about the factors culminating in what happened on Capitol Hill. Washington caused similar moves in other countries, let's say Venezuela and Serbia, for instance. Now it's experiencing it on home turf. Have the chickens come home to roost?
Yeah, that comment about banana republics, well, we know what causes coups in banana republics. This was that rare thing, a coup in a country without a U.S. embassy. right? It was also that rare thing, an attack on the U.S. government without a war in response to it, because it was an attack by people from the U.S. Can you imagine if a group of Iranian tourists or Russian or Asian tourists from anywhere in Asia had attacked the U.S. Capitol? Human life on Earth might be gone by now. So there are different responses depending on the actors. And this, of course, ironically, was on the same day that President-elect Joe Biden named Victoria Nuland as a possible nominee for Undersecretary of State, a principal organizer of a coup in Ukraine, advocate of a coup in Russia, etc. So this was the result of Congress looking at a president who instigated hateful violence against immigrants, against blacks, against women, against media, against leftists for 4 years, and saying, well, we won't do anything because we're not immigrants, we're not blacks, we're not women. And now, finally, within hours, you have dozens and dozens of Congress members wanting impeachment, which others of us have been demanding for over 4 years. You also had a very biased response by the police on Capitol Hill. If those had been peace activists or leftists with peaceful posters and signs, the police would have attacked them, not waited until they got inside the building to break out the tear gas. I mean, this was like Iraq 03, where if you're attacking anything other than the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, it's okay, go right ahead. So I think people are starting to see the bias in a supposedly fair and equal system.
Okay, now, let me, from Washington, D.C., invite former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kerriacco. John, good to have you with us. Let me ask you about the storming of the Capitol Hill. What does it say about the underlying deficit of democracy in the United States?
Well, frankly, I think democracy in the United States is showing cracks. This is the danger of populism. We saw this danger not just yesterday, but over the last 4 years, where people are repeating the president's assertions, for example, that the media are the enemy of the people, that progressives, liberals, blacks, and other minorities don't have a place in American politics, that the right is oppressed and needs to take to the streets. This is 4 years of danger just building and building, and it finally culminated yesterday in what really was, in my view, a coup attempt, and at the very least, insurrection.
Right. David, we have this YouGov report, and it says 45% of Republicans and 1 in 5 voters have backed the attack on Capitol Hill. Is this not a sign of a big division?
It is a sign of a huge division, and there was a big crowd in Washington, D.C. on the side of this coup or insurrection beyond those who took part at the Capitol building. And this is an indication of the power of the media and the idiocy of the president-elect demanding that Trump be put on television. Putting Trump on television created this crisis. We need the media outlets like Twitter to ban Trump from speaking ever again. But this is a development that comes out of decades of division, of divisive policies, of the absence of universal benefits coming from the U.S. government, a divisive, racist society where there is inequality growing, suffering growing, declining quality of life to the point where the U.S. can't be compared to most wealthy countries, has to be compared to third world countries, and people are angry. And until those on the left deliver them something, there are people who are going to turn to the right.
Now, John, we also have Ted Cruz saying that 36% of Americans see eye to eye with President Trump when it comes to complaining about vote rigging. They say there has been some fraud. So what's this supposed to indicate in a country that's always boasting of human rights and democracy?
Right. There is literally no evidence whatsoever that there was voter fraud in any of the states, whether they were close in the presidential election or not. This speech that Ted Cruz gave on the floor of the Senate last night is going to be his legacy. The sad truth is that 36% figure is likely correct. But there's always going to be a core of people who will believe Donald Trump no matter what he says. If he says the moon is made out of cheese, they'll believe that the moon is made out of cheese. And this is the danger of a president who keeps repeating a lie over and over and over again, because eventually a good solid core of Americans will believe that lie.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you think about Hussein?
That was John.
David.
John?
David.
Well, I think there is a chance that to a significant degree, Trump will fall out of favor, even among many Republicans, not because he's a lawless demagogue, not because he's a criminal bigot, but because he cost them the state of Georgia and the majority in the U.S. Senate. There will, as John rightly says, always be people who will never Trump. And this is a to immediately reconvene the Congress, impeach him, and remove him, or build the pressure to use the 25th Amendment or compel his resignation, because he will continue this. He will pardon those involved. He will run for office again if he's not barred from running for office again, which is a penalty that can be imposed through impeachment and conviction, even when someone is already out of office. And people will begin, people to the liberal side of things, will begin to see the military as the solution. I can't tell you how many people left of center yesterday were cheering for the National Guard, were cheering for the shooting of a woman in the U.S. Capitol, because they were on the Republican side rather than the Democratic side. So unless Congress acts and acts nonviolently through the rule of law, increasingly people on both sides of politics in the U.S. are going to see force and militarism as the solution, and this is a danger that extends beyond Trumpism.
Okay, John, let me now read part of a tweet by veteran U.S. diplomat Richard Haass. The tweet goes, "So much for the peaceful transfer of power. We already knew what we need to know about this president. The question is, how do we get to where so many Americans are so willing to throw democracy overboard?" Your take on that, please.
Richard Haass is one of the most experienced former diplomats that we have in think tanks. He's the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so he's seen presidents come and go. And like the rest of us, I think he's never seen a president like this one. What he's saying is exactly right. And what David said a moment ago is exactly right. We've had 4 years of this demagogue, out of control demagogue. We need to bring sanity back to our policy. And I'm not saying that Joe Biden necessarily is, you know, the perfect president-elect to bring sanity back. He's certainly a neoliberal and has supported wars all over the world. But I think so many Americans have come to the conclusion that anybody is better than Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And David, one basic question, and what caused all this to happen? I mean, pushing half Americans to vote for somebody like Trump, you know, with all of his personal attributes, as you know better. Because this could stay and this could go on and it could still threaten the United States in different ways.
I think unless we get something dramatically better than what can be expected of Joe Biden left to his own devices, we will have a return of Trump or Trumpism in a different guise or something worse. I mean, until the left or the center in U.S. politics delivers people health care and retirement and job prospects and a peaceful, prosperous, sustainable society with a good outlook for their children, stops coming in last in handling disease pandemics, stops coming in first in brutal imprisonment and incarceration, stops coming in last in retirement and security and sense of well-being, then you're going to have people resorting to this sort of demagogue who promises them that the whole problem is some other group and what's needed is to bash them, and at least it'll make you feel good even if you're still sick and hungry. And so it's not enough to get anybody other than Trump. Anybody other than Trump on its own is going to bring us back Trump. And unless Trump, as I said, is barred from running for office again, he himself is likely to run for office again.
Mm-hmm. And John, this Trumpism, this ideology is staying there. It's not only Trump, it could be manifested in somebody else. Let's see what the root causes have been.
Yeah, the root causes are angry white men really believe that they're being discriminated against. It's the craziest thing. They really believe that policies enacted over the last decades favor minorities, and they believe that Christianity is being squelched across the United States. to many observers, including me, it's so preposterous as to be laughable. But they really do believe this. And to pick up on a point that David made a moment ago, Trumpism without Donald Trump is alive and well. There is a possibility, a good possibility, that Donald Trump will run for president again. But we're already seeing people like Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who are emulating Donald Trump in their speeches now in order to appeal to his base of support so that when they run for president in 4 years, and I'm sure all three of them will, they're going to sound just like Donald Trump.
Right. And David, basically, why should there be this bipartisan thing, you know, should be this domineering across the whole U.S. politics, no third party, you know, got any chance of, you know, getting any serious votes? What's wrong with this? Why the duopoly?
Well, I think that is a major part of the problem, especially in combination with even bigger parts of the problem, including the legalized system of bribery, of what are called bribes in other countries, but campaign contributions in the United States system, combined with the media problem. You have a corrupt, quasi-state corporate media system that shuts out alternatives. So it's not just the winner-take-all system, which, yes, could be reformed into a proportional or parliamentarian system, but it's that problem compounded many-fold by the financial corruption, by the media control, by the domination of the media and the ballots and the system by these two parties, not by the government, but by those two parties together. You know, we need major reforms to the system if we're going to get something we could call representative, much less democratic.
Now, John, what do you think? Why shouldn't any independents or third parties have anything to say in the elections?
You know, I think we are in dire need of viable third parties. I have voted third party in the last two elections, and, you know, the duopoly that we have, it just simply doesn't work anymore. We need a progressive party. Maybe non-Trump moderate Republicans need some sort of right-of-center party. And what we have now, the Greens and the Libertarians, are being officially oppressed in the respect that they're not allowed to automatically appear on ballots in all 50 states. They have a very difficult time raising money. They're not invited to debates, which means their ideas are never heard. That's got to change if there's going to be real movement on Capitol Hill, if there's going to be a real desire among the American people to try to clean up this system. It's clearly broken.
Now, David, Moscow has reacted to this Capitol incident. It blames what it calls the archaic electoral process in the U.S., which is not democratic. Now, the question is, why shouldn't popular votes decide election results?
Well, historically, because the states want power as entities rather than just human beings. I think weighing the pros and cons, we would be better off with human beings having all of the power in this instance rather than the states. And there are a number of states and organizations and activists making huge progress in that direction, likely to succeed in the relatively near future, either by getting enough states to commit to honoring the national popular vote, the whoever wins the most nationally wins, or by enough states deciding on their own, as they are perfectly free to do and always have been, to distribute their electoral college votes proportionally, you know, not giving them all to the single person who gets the majority or even just the plurality in that state. There are currently two states that do it that way. The other 48 are free to start doing it that way tomorrow. We just have to build enough public pressure in that direction.
All right, John, what do you think about that? Popular vote or electoral college?
I think popular vote is the only way that we can have real democracy. The Electoral College is a holdover from the 18th century and the 19th century. It was meant to ensure states' rights. It was meant to ensure the power and authority of landowners. It's antiquated. We really have to change it.
Well, David, can this be mended? I mean, this system we're talking about, when we're finding faults with it, what can be done about it?
Well, all kinds of things can be reformed. We can clean the money out. We can effectively or literally get rid of the Electoral College. We can create publicly funded media. We can support useful popular media. We can become better, wiser consumers and producers of media and communications. We can pressure Congress members and presidents and officials quite apart from elections. I mean, we've had success in already defeating a couple of the worst nominees for cabinet positions in the upcoming government without any elections playing any role in that whatsoever. But, you know, Biden, as of yesterday, has lost the Senate excuse. He was going to be able to say, I'm powerless to do anything good or change anything dramatically because of the Senate. That excuse is gone. So now, immediately, any big reforms that we want that we don't get, we can blame on the Democratic Party, which has complete power in the legislative and executive branches. So if we don't get decent wages and decent health care and an end to wars and a restoration of the Iran agreement and some movement on abolishing sanctions and a better approach on coronavirus and on, there's no big excuse available anymore.
Right.
So now's the time to make these demands.
Okay, John, we have 30 seconds for your final comments.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. And we also really need public financing of presidential campaigns. The big corporations are the ones that control the political process, and the oligarchs in the United States. That has to change.
Okay. And on that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests who joined us with our comments. We had former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kiriakou from Washington, D.C., and author and commentator David Swanson from Charlottesville, Virginia. See you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The article you're going to hear has been penned by Robert Lewis. Robert Lewis is a lawyer licensed in California. He has worked in leading US, UK, and Chinese law firms in China for nearly 30 years. The article is titled, Under Biden, US Set to Resume Globalist Policies. Joe Biden's victory in the U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump's America First doctrine will be jettisoned, and Biden will seek to return the United States to pre-Trumpian norms. That is expected to mean a return to the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and perhaps even the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meanwhile, the challenges in the Sino-U.S. relationship will not have magically gone away when Biden takes over, and political matters in relation to China are now so entrenched in the US that no major substantive policy changes may be possible. Faith would have it, Joe Biden and his fellow Democrats again find themselves assuming power in the wake of a global economic downturn. In 2009, it was in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis. Now, it is in the midst of a renewed lockdowns across Europe and the United States. In an effort to try to stop the second wave of COVID-19 infections from overwhelming the healthcare system. It will likely take many months into the Biden administration for vaccines to bring the United States, its allies and the other major industrialized nations and other affected parts of the world back to normal. So there are two parts to the Biden administration's goal of getting things back to normal. There is the pre-Trumpian globalist normal, and then there is the pre-pandemic normal. At some point, he and other Western leaders will have to explain why China and other parts of Asia have been back to normal since the late second quarter of 2020, while a return to normal in the United States and Europe now is not projected to occur until at least the third quarter in 2021, at the earliest. Politicians always deflect blame for problems. Donald Trump blamed China for the pandemic. Joe Biden will blame Donald Trump for any pandemic-related problems going forward. In any event, Biden will have to play the cards he has been dealt, and his performance will be measured by actual results. A key component of the global system is trade, and the system is designed to promote more open trade in order to increase global trade volumes and economic development. Donald Trump's America First doctrine is generally understood to be protectionist in nature, and thus presumably anti-trade. His use of tariffs as instruments of trade warcraft similarly has been criticized as antithetical to sound economic and trade principles. However, historical trade statistics over the last decade paint a picture that suggests that continued growth in global trade may not be directly tied to who is in the White House. During the Obama-Biden years, after a steep decline in global export trade volumes in 2009 following the global financial crisis, global exports rebounded rapidly to set new highs for a period of four consecutive years, from 2011 through to 2014, ultimately reaching a peak of $18.9 trillion in 2014. In contrast, in 2015 and 2016, global trade volumes declined by more than 15%, putting global trade levels back on par with pre-crash levels and erasing all the gains in the preceding years. Then comes along a virus. In April of this year, global trade volumes plummeted a remarkable 12.2% in just 1 month. To put this in context, from January of 2010, the monthly change in trade volume had been characterized by an alternating series of small peaks and small valleys, generally with month-on-month increases of no more than 2.5% and decreases of less than 2%. In light of the precipitous drop in trade volumes due to the pandemic, the World Trade Organization WTO projected in April that trade volumes were set to plunge by between 13% and an almost unimaginable 32% for the full year 2020. This dire forecast by the World Trade Organization experts failed to recognize the apparently unstoppable momentum of global trade, even in the midst of a global pandemic. In May, the monthly decline in trade volume was only 0.9%, and the June trade volumes had jumped back into the plus column, giving 7.9%, followed by smaller but still historically high rates of increase over the next 4 months. By early October, the World Trade Organization had revised its guidance to forecast an overall 9.2% decline in trade in goods for 2020, followed by a 7.2% rise in 2021. The forecast drop for 2020 is still sobering, but pales in comparison with the more than 22% decline in global trade in 2009 after the global financial crisis. The forecast 2020 drop is also smaller than the two-year decline of more than 15% in the last part of the Obama-Biden administration. Some additional historical perspective is required to more fully understand the irresistible force of global trade. Even with a modest decline from 2018, as noted above, global trade for 2019 was still up more than 350% over 1995 levels, which were $5.19 trillion, and a remarkable 6,300% higher than 1970 level of trade, which was $302.3 billion. It appears, at least so far, that not even a pandemic can stop the long-term growth of global trade. As author and columnist Zachary Carabel commented in March, when we assess the prospects for global trade going forward in the full historical context, it would appear more plausible that the most coronavirus future will see not an end to the globalizing trend of recent decades, but a new chapter in the story. Stated otherwise, if Donald Trump and COVID-19 did not derail global trade, maybe nothing can.